On this episode of the Reflex Blue Show, Nate Voss and I talk to the one, the only, Debbie Millman.
Oh, this is the first time I've seen this. I mean, this trip.
Yo, it's a pretty new microphone. We've only had it for a couple weeks.
Oh, you want to take a picture of it too?
Nate, you want to start?
No, are we... Roger, sorry, I was going to... Now that I have this little thing.
And does it just pick up direct noise, or does it pick up everything?
It's unidirectional. Yeah. Omnidirectional. Yeah. That's the thing.
And if it doesn't pick up your voice, we will dub it back in ourselves.
I would love for you to open this one.
Welcome to the Reflex Blue Show.
We were already doing it, weren't we?
This is Nate Voss.
Hi, I'm Nate Voss, everybody.
And we brought in our guest, Debbie Millman. Debbie, how are you doing today?
I'm amazing now that I'm seeing you two.
Aw.
So nice.
Feeling the same way.
Thank you. Pretty stoked
about it.
Yeah, this is awesome.
I heard you've had a fantastic presentation yesterday. Stephanie was gushing about it, and then I think she has gushed to you several times about it since.
Well,
which
she's just, you know, family, so I'm not sure that counts.
You can take that one. You can count that one.
We can't be everywhere at once, so we sent ace reporter and sleuth Tom Nemitz to your presentation, and he came back to report on it, too. And he said, for once, you actually spoke about yourself.
I did.
Because I've seen you speak half a dozen times, but it's always about either the mind or about science or about... the history of brand. And
I was going to say, sometimes work, but the science ones, I like those.
I've never actually seen a work one, so this one was actually just about you and about, was that different to do, or have you done this
it's
before?
It's been a process of difference. I started to put together this presentation last summer when I had my show at the Chicago Design Museum, and they asked if I would also not only show the work, but some of my personal work, but also make a presentation. And I was dumbstruck because I didn't have a presentation. And I'm, at this point, practically a professional presenter.
Right.
So I had to put something together. And as presentations often go, it's been a build and a build and a change and a build and a knockdown and a build. And so it's been a series of iterations to get to this place, but I would say it's pretty much all about me.
All about growing up, Debbie.
Yes, sadly, with pictures to prove it. Actually,
nice. A lot of growing up photos at this this house. I've seen a lot of those.
And this was also about rejection through your life.
Yes, it was called, and in the brochure, it is named On Failure: How the Worst Moments of Your Life Can Turn Out to Be the Best. But I think I might change it to On Rejection, because it's really about being rejected sort of over and over and over again, and how do you create a life that you want after being rejected numerous times. And it's all very autobiographical.
I think that's a great distinction to make. I think that a lot of people take rejection as failure, like that those two things equate one another when it's, you know, unless what you're chasing is hyper-specific to, is this one person or this one opportunity going to work out this very specific way that I want it to, and then you get rejected, you might be able to call that a failure. But really, just rejection, I've found, is just, you know, it's a fork in the road. It's a turn instead of a stop.
And until you are old enough to see the value of that trajectory, it's often hard to imagine being anything but rejected, or anything coming out of a rejection other than rejection in the sort of grander scheme of a life and experience. And that is, I think, the big lesson in the presentation, that the worst, what I thought was, up until that point in my life, the worst professional experience that I'd ever been through, and it had culminated in this experience. There were littler ones all along the way, but this gigantic one felt insurmountable. And yet, had that not happened now, if I look back at it 10 years later, because it's 10 years since that occurred, I doubt I'd be on this radio show.
And is that the, do you want to talk about it at all? Is that the, I've only heard one or two stories coming out of your talk, but I rolled the dice. I went to Jessica Walsh only because I'm like, wow, okay.
Oh, come on. She's sexier. She's prettier. She's younger. She might have gotten naked.
She is younger, and there was a 50-50 chance. I was like.
Yeah, and you know you're not getting any nudity when you come to one of mine. You know, you're lucky I don't talk science.
Yet, anyway. There's still time.
We don't know what's in those slides. Maybe how people would have accidentally, like, swapped the slides from the presentation.
Wouldn't that have been funny? Okay, Jessica, you do Debbie's presentation. She's going to do yours.
But the only nudity then is a bunch of Sagmeister.
Here's a slide. She's getting hit in the face with a pie. I don't know what she's doing, but she's pretty cool. She was good. Anyway, so that's why I missed yours. I feel like they put the Giants up against each other for that one. That was my dilemma. So was it the AIGA story? Is the one
it was AIGA about? And Speak Up.
When you were getting picking online fights.
I wasn't picking the online fights. Felix Sockwell.
I feel like those fights got thrown at you.
We can't picture that. we blogged back in the day. That does not sound familiar at all.
Remember how, like, how important all of that was at the time? Like, it was such a big thing to be blogging and to be commenting on blogs about graphic design. And it was just, like, all-consuming for, like, a year and a half, 2 years there.
I think once Facebook and Twitter came in, all the comments went there.
It kind of broke off, right?
But there's not the
same participation. Yeah. I think, ironically, there's still quite the same, if not more, readership.
Oh, yeah.
Our site grows sort of incrementally every year, or volumetrically, I should say, every year. It was really – it was a big deal at the time.
Yeah.
And online bullying hadn't really begun either.
No one knew what to call it yet. Yeah, people were just being dicks on the internet.
Exactly.
You had to learn how to deal with that.
We always had a rule. The first 7 comments on a post were normally pretty good, and by comment 8 down, it was just vile.
Yeah.
Vile and hate.
Paula Scher did a brilliant arc of a conversation – on a blog post.
I feel like I've seen
that. And at first, it's like everybody comes out and says some positive things, and then somebody comes in and says something negative, and then everybody piles on the negative comments, and then they keep going and going and going, and then somebody, either the person who's being bullied or somebody else, has a different point of view, and then slowly everybody comes around to the other point of view, and by the time it's over, everybody's friends again.
You just got to stick with it long enough. If you jump off halfway through, it's just going to be all anger and hate.
But it had come on the heels of a rejection from AIGA, and the rejection from Speak Up was based on their assessment of a situation that they believed was my being accepted by AIGA.
Mm.
And so there was a real irony here that they were bullying me or criticizing me for being and criticizing AIGA for allowing me in, when in fact they hadn't. So that's also what made it so difficult, that the bullying was occurring over something that wasn't even true.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know.
Believe it or not.
Something like that happened on the internet. Somebody didn't check their facts before plowing forward with a horrible, horrible opinion. Yeah.
Now, did this rejection or writing about your rejection make it easier to take, or is it still?
No, it doesn't hurt at all anymore. It didn't hurt after a couple of months when all of a sudden.
No, I meant just rejection in general.
In general.
Obviously, you're doing a whole speech on rejection. Obviously, you have a different. I didn't know if your perspective on rejection changed after, like, putting it all together and actually talking about it.
There was a lot of shame that I felt about the earlier rejections in my life, being rejected from schools or being rejected from programs that I wanted to take and participate in. I don't feel quite the same shame about it, obviously, if I'm talking about it publicly. I mean, at the time, I remember getting a letter from the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism and being so humiliated about the rejection that I think I, like, ripped up the letter and never told anybody about it. Now, I feel so grateful about where I am that I look back at that particular rejection and I'm almost grateful about that, if it means that I'm here.
You can kind of trace an arc, and you've kind of been touching on this, where if you wind up someplace that is much more positive than what you would have ever expected, you know, way back when, and you think, okay, well, these six or seven really horrible things had to happen to me so that I was in this position at this time, so that this opportunity would open up, and so that now I'm in this much better place. I can attest to a lot of that myself. Isn't it strange, though, how, like, you spoke about feeling shame for these rejections, how that kind of just sticks with you. And I can think about something from, I don't know, getting rejected by a girl in high school, and I can feel just as awful about it for a moment today as though it had just happened, and then I was, oh, well, that's just, you know, high school kids being high school kids. But it can kind of hang on in that way.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah. I mean, I never have liked being rejected, and this...
I don't know of anyone who likes it, per se.
Well, I mean, I'm horrified by it. Maybe that's a better word.
Yeah.
I'm still horrified by it. No amount of rejections, no pile-on of rejections, I think, makes it easier to deal with rejection. I still feel it profoundly if Sterling is pitching for a job and we don't win it. Mm-hmm. I still feel it profoundly if one of my students drops out of my class.
That is one of the worst. Even if it's a bad student, you and
worst,
I have taught.
My worst was like when the good student dropped out and he just didn't show up, and it's like, what happened?
I know.
And I found
what
him.
What did I do?
I ran into him like a month later, and he's like, oh, did no one tell you? I got a full-time job, and I just... And it's like, oh, okay, it wasn't me.
I feel rejected when somebody walks out of the room when I'm presenting my presentation on rejection.
Yeah.
Very
That's
meta.
Awesome.
I'm just getting meta.
I did time mine, so you said the word rejection as I turned my back, right? I mean,
right.
That's how it worked.
Yeah.
No. I like to just go into the back of the room and just stand with my face to the wall if I don't like it. I don't leave.
I think Nate's the type that would come into... your presentation multiple times, just to leave multiple times.
Well, I know it's me.
I did. I did bounce around a little bit yesterday. I thought Jessica did a really great job up front, and then I think the middle of hers was sort of the then I went to college portion, and I was like, I'm good with people going to college, so I thought I would bounce around to a couple other people, and everyone that I went into, I was not feeling anymore. There was a guy. I don't want to name names or like drop it out. There was one guy being like super negative and like really cynical up on stage.
Wow.
And I was just like, this is way worse. I would so much rather hear somebody talking about going to college. So I headed back in there and caught the end of her talk, and it was super rad. So I probably should have just stayed for that whole thing.
Well, I'm still struck by Austin Kleon saying,
oh, he was great, wasn't he?
Oh my God, he was wonderful. Talking about how all advice is autobiographical.
Yeah.
And I think that all conversation is autobiographical. I think everything is autobiographical. Everything that we do, everything that we communicate, everything that we present, everything that we stand for, we come to that stance with who we are. And I don't think we can ever get away from that. And so whatever the reaction is, whatever the participation is, whatever the involvement is, it's always from a position of how you see the world.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. We're gonna take a break, and when we come back, we want to talk about where the rejection led with you becoming president of AIG National for...
Okay.
Is that a three-year stint?
It was a three-year stint.
Three-year stint.
Yeah. And then was announced in Dallas.
So Debbie, you actually, this rejection somehow led to you becoming president of the whole AIG National Organization for 3 years, which I think you were last time you were on the show.
That's so very possible.
Yeah, it was.
It actually might have been as I was becoming president.
I think it was right before. I don't know, though. Somebody listening, just figure it out. let us know. And you, post to the blog.
And during your time there, I heard you actually visited basically every chapter.
I didn't visit every chapter, but I am pretty close, and I'm still.
Are you still working on that list?
I am. Who's I have this goal of having visited all. At the moment, there are 67 chapters.
Okay, chapters that are not seen. Debbie, give her a call.
Alabama. I'm waiting.
I kind of want to know which ones haven't you been to yet.
Birmingham. Yeah. So I need that call from you guys. Well, I wouldn't say that my presidency was because of my rejection. My presidency happened despite my rejection.
Yeah.
I was rejected after participating in the special interest brand experience group. I had participated in that group for several years back in the late 90s, early 2000s, I think for perhaps 3 years. And it was a brand new group, and the new group had created bylaws and a board and all of the other things that the chapters have, and I was on that original board. And when my term was up, everybody whose term was up was encouraged to reapply if they wanted to stay on the board, but there was no guarantee that you'd be chosen to be on the board again. But I had been pretty active, and I was very, very passionate about being in this group, and you know, sort of was the kind of person that, you know, was always making the cupcakes, you know, to help raise money and, you know, that kind of thing, metaphorically.
I'm going to go completely literal with that in my imagination.
and then I was voted off. I was voted off the board by the nominating committee or the review committee, and I was just absolutely devastated. I mean, I was really, really crushed.
It's a hard thing, especially for a volunteer organization, and it feels like you're giving so much of yourself to, you know, to see this thing grow or to make something of it, to then just say, no, we don't want you to do that anymore.
Yeah. It was outright rejection.
Yeah.
They broke up with me. They
stone cold.
Dumped me. Absolutely. And I was devastated because I had put so much of my heart and soul into helping build this little group and got a lot of joy and fulfillment from it. So when they rejected me, I really questioned whether or not there was even a place for me within AIGA and seriously considered just letting my membership lapse and sort of going off into the sunset, tail between my legs, tried, didn't work, sorry, bye-bye. And Rick Griffey, the executive director, actually encouraged me to stick it out, to try to stay involved and continue to participate. And as a consolation prize for being kicked to the curb, he asked if I would be a juror in the upcoming annual competition, 365. And he asked me to be a juror.
Which is no longer around.
Which is no longer around, sadly. But he asked me to be a juror in the packaging design section, which I was gleeful about. And at that point, it was like, who cares about the right experience group? I'm a juror. Hello, world. And so I did that. But the day of the actual jurying, I didn't get on terribly well with one of the other jurors who was really quite elitist in terms of what she considered to be worthy of an award and just outright discounted anything that was sold in a supermarket or a drugstore, which is 99% of the work that I do at Sterling. And so it felt a little bit dismissive and also unfair because I did feel like there were a couple of things that deserved commendation.
I feel like that is the battlefield for package design. If you can stand out in a Walmart or a Target on, you know, 8 or 9 foot tall shelves lined with, let's say, thousands of products, like, you're doing your job right. I like standing out with specialty packaging in a specialty shop with a perfect little table and maybe some flowers around it to look at this incredible box. Like, that's almost easier. That's almost cheating, right?
Well, in any case, she and I didn't get on very well.
Right.
And from however many hundreds of entrants, I think we were able to agree on 7 that would be included in the journal. And when the journal came out, it featured the biographies of the jurors, and
which most of the big organizations do that.
Yeah. And so my work was represented by the Burger King logo and the identity that we did for Star Wars Episode 2, Attack of the Clones.
It's very good of you to say the entire title.
Thank you. Well, there are your Star Wars fans, your listeners that are Star Wars fans that would expect nothing less
from
me.
That would also just be us.
Okay.
It's not our listeners, that's just us.
I don't want to get into it, but I've had to move on.
Okay. So in any case, when the annual came out and the Speak Up crowd, who had been really vocal about putting AIGA in its place and the relevance of the organization and so on and so forth, took this inclusion of me and my work to represent the organization's utter downfall from its once great state, and accused AIGA of selling out to corporate clowns.
I was just gonna ask if that was because of the corporate nature.
The corporate nature and by who they referred to as she-devil Debbie Millman. And so that was harsh.
Man, the internet.
Yeah. That was harsh.
Imagine Paul Rand. I think he might have sold out too.
I remember when people were on Speak Up trashing Paul Rand's work. I was just like, you guys, what are you doing? Like, what in your life is happening that it's so important to you to get on?
I think it was the Enron logo. I think it was the Enron logo. Yeah. They weren't trashing him for much else. And I even think he didn't feel like that was his best. But nevertheless,
that's also damaged goods, not because of him.
Exactly. A logo can really only represent an organization's values in the grand scheme of things, and so we know what that means. But in any case, long story short, there was this big irony here. I have this article being written about the fact that I'm being included and how terrible and proof of the civilization's doom that I'm part of this thing, when in fact the only reason I was part of it was because I was kicked to the curb in that other place. And so it was just this big pile-on of rejection. And that was the moment where, back in May of 2003, a mere 10 years ago, I was really questioning whether or not I should even be in this business at all.
Yeah. Glad you stuck it out.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. We're going to take one more break, and then we'll be right back. All right, so ended up that not only you stuck it out, but you became head of the AIJ for 3 years as president.
Yeah.
What was the thing you're most proud of that you did while you were there?
Well, visiting so many of the chapters. My term was really about creating a sense of connectivity and inclusion with the members. Because I know what it felt like and still know what it feels like, but I very, very passionately felt that anyone that felt excluded in any way within AIGA needed to feel like they were welcome. And so that was also part of why I wanted so badly to connect with the chapters, because I wanted people to feel like they were being heard, they were being listened to, we cared about their world and their issues and their trials and tribulations and successes. So visiting the chapters was a really, really important aspect of my presidency, and then also growing our social media presence. So when I started my term, I think we had about 60,000 followers, and the followers had been collecting, you know, for years and years and years.
Right.
And my goal during my presidency was to try to get it up to 100,000. And by the time I left, we were up to over 300,000. So I felt really good.
All right.
So really having that interactive exchange with the members. And so
which goes hand in hand with feeling inclusive.
Yeah, absolutely. Everybody has a voice. Everybody has a point of view that is important. So that's what I feel most excited about having accomplished.
Sure. Nice. Let's talk about future accomplishments. Okay. First night at Howe, Bridget from Howe gets up on the main stage and says, "You guys, we've got a lot of exciting things happening. We're doing a thing with Debbie. And I can't tell you anything about it. Now, knowing that this show isn't going to air for like 6 weeks.
Okay. Well, I can tell you a little
bit about
it.
What can you tell us about it?
I mean, the reason she couldn't tell you more about it is because it's still very, very amorphous. And we're hoping that it's going to be a conference unlike any other. It's not going to be a conference about branding. Mm-hmm. It's not going to be a conference about packaging. It's not going to be a conference about design. It's going to be a conference about thinking, about thought leadership, about creating a better you.
What's the timeline on this? Is this?
I think it'll be sometime 2014, but again, it's still really amorphous. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be like anything else that's out there. I don't want it to compete with anything else that's out there. It's definitely not going to cannibalize on anything that's already being done here.
Right.
I really want it to be a brand new way of thinking about information being shared and inspiration.
Okay, I'm... Put me on your e-newsletter for that. Okay,
you got it.
So that
you got it.
Where do people go for when this starts to come together? Do you guys have a place? Do they just follow you on Twitter? Do you want them to follow you somewhere else?
Following on Twitter is good.
Do you guys have an ecosystem built up around this project yet?
No,
where people can get the e-newsletter and connect on the six different points of social media? Do you have a YouTube channel yet for it?
Not yet.
Okay.
All right, so follow Debbie and Howe on Twitter, and one of them will announce something
more
as it kind of comes out.
Yeah.
More.
I mean, if I had to compare it to anything at all out there, and again, this is not about being better than it or competing with it, but the sort of sensibility I wanted to have is the TED conference.
That's what I thought of when you were talking about it a second ago, and then I didn't want to say that because I was like, she wants it to be something new, so I probably shouldn't be like, that reminds me of TED. But
I could see it somehow being inspired and influenced by, or you know, to talk about how Austin Kleon might say it, just to steal from it and make it better.
And reference, and that slide of his, like, how to steal and be awesome, or how to steal and be terrible.
Right.
You'd be on the awesome
side. No, it's all about all about being honorable.
Awesome.
Absolutely.
So, and then you said that you had awesome things to talk about with regards to your books.
Well, I have.
How are your books going?
They're great. I have not had a book out in a while, so I'm very excited about what is coming. Print Magazine actually approached me to take the visual essays that I have been doing for the last 3 or 4 years, mm-hmm. Every month on the imprint site. They approached me to collect them, add some new work to it, and create a picture book.
Oh, nice.
Basically. So it's a book of my, it's similar to Look Both Ways in some ways. Mm-hmm. Look Both Ways being the book that I did, of visual essays on the intersection of life and design.
And I think that was the last time you were on the show, I think you were just promoting that book.
Yeah, so that was, I think, 2009. And
which is weird that that's starting to have been a long time ago.
Yeah. And so this is called Self-Portrait as Your Trader. And it is a collection of about 10 or so visual essays. And it's completely handmade. So I don't even know, other than the copyright page, I don't know that there's...
You're making each book.
No.
Yourself.
What I mean is
you're sewing in the pages at home at night.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
For each order.
Yeah,
and
every
then just
order.
Filling in with random scrapbook pages.
Selling them on Etsy.
Yours, maybe
this one's got a coffee stain
sale.
On it.
Yeah.
No, I'm thinking that aside from the front matter, which I think legally has to be in a certain size font or whatever, the whole thing is going to be handmade. Like, there's not going to be even one piece of set typography in it.
I don't know. Chase after that page, though. Go for it. Just see if you can.
We are.
Just like the page is scrawled, painting, copyright, the most boring content in the world, and then just... Take that page. See if you can take that page. That is going to be the story of that I'm most interested in.
Is this book done and just waiting to be printed?
We're finishing it up now. It's going to be 9x12, so it's a little bit oversized. It's more like a coffee table book.
Yeah.
And it's coinciding with an exhibit that I'm having in the fall at Anderson University. And so there'll be new work. I have a couple of new visual graphic movies that I've been doing, and in case for your listeners that might not be aware of what the movies are, I draw in real time as I'm watching a movie, pieces of the movie, pieces of text, pieces of scenery, pieces of emotion. And
where do they go to see these?
They go to the imprint site on Print Magazine's website.
Okay.
And that's where they're all held. So it'll be some visual movies or graphic movies, pieces from my visual essays, sort of large size printouts, and some experiments in ceramics that I do with my cousin.
Fun.
Yeah.
All right. Donovan, do you have any more questions for our illustrious guest?
I think
guest?
Since we've last talked to you, Design Matters has moved over to Design Observer.
Well, that was so long ago. That was like for EBS.
That was like also in 2009, though. So maybe.
So really 2009? Oh, my God.
Just moved. Yeah. How's that been going? Have you like?
It's great. It's great. They've been amazing. I think the listenership has increased tenfold because of the range and the sort of reach of Design Observer. It's been about 3 or 4 years because I do about 26 shows a year, and we're up to 70-something since moving over to Design Observer. And in the time between Voice America and Design Observer, it was about a year. So yeah, it's about 4 years ago that we made the change, and it's been amazing. It's been great. They promote the show. They tweet about the show. They got it up on SoundCloud. They have it in iTunes in a really cool way, and they're great. You know, Bill and Jessica and Michael.
Yeah.
You can't ask for better advocates.
No.
All right. Well, Debbie, we really appreciate your time, and we hope to run into you soon.
Absolutely.
I hope to run into you as often as humanly possible. It's actually, you know what? Seriously, it's been like 2 years since I've seen you, so it's been really nice to see you with this
thing.
I know,
you too.
As busy as everything is, it's great to get you away for a little time.
Thank you, and congratulations to your wife Stephanie Voss, who presented here.
Thank you.
At the conference and knocked it out of the ballpark
She did pretty good. Yeah. Pretty stoked about that.
Yeah, she's pretty awesome.
Really, pretty engaged audience. The people that stayed, she had a really awesome like shout out to the people that stayed, and she kind of. It's like, those other people that left, we're not worried about those guys.
Yeah, everybody leaves.
I know. She was super cool about it. So that was my favorite part.
Left four times.
Yeah,
exactly.
I was like, I've heard this. I'm good.
Well, he wants to go see Jessica Walsh again.
I'm like, now my wife's talking about when she went to college. I'm not doing that. It was great. Thank you. I'll let her know you said that. So
cool.
Thanks everybody for listening. I'm sure we'll be back soon.
Thanks for listening to the Reflex Blue Show. For more information, visit 36point.com. The Reflex Blue Show was created by Donovan Beery and Nate Voss. Music by Ben Luters.